everybody. Welcome to the Microsoft Technology Center in Irvine, California. My name is Paul Edlund. And today you probably thought you were coming here to learn about how we would protect you using the hybrid cloud. But instead, what I'm actually going to focus on is protecting you from the zombie apocalypse. And so with that, before I go to the zombie apocalypse, actually, let's just reset the conversation around the theme that we've been following over the course of the last three webcasts, specifically on this idea around this company called Contoso Insurance. And we know that you know that Contoso is a fictional company. However, the examples and the stories and all of the anecdotes that we've used over the course of this series are very, very much real. And so while I might be talking to you about this Contoso company, believe me when I tell you that the stories are real. As a matter of fact, I live in Chicago, and actually last weekend I was at a friend's house, and we were traveling home at around 10 o'clock at night, and right after we passed through the underpass in this image that you're seeing on my screen, it got flooded with 6 feet of water. And during those events, right, insurance companies like Contoso get flooded or deluged with a ton of claims and people asking for responses very quickly, right, because your house is being impacted, your property is damaged. And so in this example of Contoso, what you've experienced or what you've heard over the course of the last few series is that Contoso is literally struggling under the weight of all of these claims and people trying to get their money back, essentially. In addition, during this session, one other factor that we're going to introduce is they also have to worry about security, right? Those concerns don't go away. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that we're going to introduce into this conversation is the idea that Contoso's under the threat of a breach. And so what I'm going to do to you today is with you today is explain how some of those breaches work, how Microsoft's platform works together to help you guys absorb some of those breaches and mitigate them quickly. So, a little bit of a promise before we get started. First of all, whenever I sit through a presentation, the one thing that I cannot stand is when somebody sits there and tries to scare me into action. Especially in the world of cybersecurity, we can't stop ourselves. It seems like we always have to scare you for some reason. I am not going to scare you today. The other thing that I'm not going to do is beat you up with a bunch of facts and figures that tell you how much money you're going to lose, how long the bad guys are going to be in there. I do have a handful of numbers that I provide during this content, but most of them are just providing background information. So no scares, no fear, no big numbers, etc. With that, if you know anything about me, I live in the city of Chicago, as I mentioned. Every year, Halloween is a huge event for us. As a matter of fact, last year I got zombieitis from my daughter. It was a mild case. You're seeing it here. I found some salve. I fixed it all up. But the thing is that if I have five parties in my house for Halloween, three of them I'll be a zombie. And so I'm very familiar with zombies. And so what I wanted to just tell you a little bit about is there's a great presentation by a guy named Johnny Long on YouTube, and I would encourage you to go look it up. He talks about how IT is relatively similar to surviving a zombie attack. So what I'm going to show you here is just some of the things that he put up around surviving a zombie attack. And so I'm not going to walk through what was on the screen here, but what I do want to mention is how this correlates to the realm of security. So in terms of the first one, don't get bitten, and duh. In terms of security, don't get breached. I think that makes sense. The next one that Johnny mentioned in his presentation was having the right shoes. If you're going to be attacked by zombies, chances are you don't want to be running around in high heels. Get a pair of boots or a pair of running shoes. Find some backups. You're going to need them. Consequently, in the world of security, you're going to need the right tools. And not only should you have the right tools, you have to test them occasionally, right? The next one is, in the presentation, he's actually a little politically incorrect. He says, don't hang with fat people. Now, I'm going to try and tune that back and say, actually, maybe you should just hang with healthy folks. In terms of how we correlate that to IT and security, you need a healthy team, right? You need a team that's versed in cybersecurity. And if you don't have one, you need to rent one. Next is stock up on resources and park them someplace safe. Secure your assets. And by the way, you should know what the keys to your kingdom are. If you're not sure what the true keys to your kingdom are, what the intellectual property is that runs your business, you should find out. And specifically, you should have plans and sub-plans and sub-sub-plans to mitigate against the loss of that data. That's the one thing that you need to focus on. Next is zombies don't swim, you should get a boat. And seriously, why wouldn't you want a boat? Just get a boat. I have no correlation for that one. Just get a boat. The next one is that, you know, if you ever saw the movie 10 Cloverfield Lane, you'll notice that they buried themselves in this bomb shelter, and that didn't work out so well for them, especially if you don't know why you're there. But the thing about being isolated, especially in the event of a breach, is that doesn't work because you're going to need to make money. You're going to need to eat while you transform your business. And so isolating yourself is not really a reality. You have to have plans for keeping the lights on while you're securing yourself from that breach. And your exercises should emulate that experience, right? Keeping the lights on. Next one down is don't elect a psychopath, stay together. I'm not going to make any political statements here. If you have a political slant on this message, I'm not going there. But in the world of IT, we have this concept called RACI. And RACI stands for Responsible, Accountable, Consulted, and Informed. And there's plenty of really great documents around how RACI processes work. I would just encourage you to take a look at one of those and figure out how it applies to your cybersecurity footprint or how you guys run your cybersecurity incidents. Next is zombie-proof your house. Basically, maintain your readiness. This is not a one-and-done event, right? You're not going to set up a bunch of tools and then be like, okay, cool, we got that, and move on to something else. No, you're going to have to emulate these breaches occasionally. You're going to have to make sure that all this stuff works. You're going to have to make sure that the RACI process is still applicable. This is not one-and-done. And then lastly, have a backup for everything. And I mean, like, literally, just have a backup for everything. And also, coming back to that knowing what the keys to your kingdom are, you really have to make sure that you test those processes. I know so many companies, really big companies, who have failed and haven't tested their backup processes thoroughly, and it shot them in the foot. So back them up. Make sure you test them. All right, really quickly, to provide you with some backstop, I'm going to get into the meat and potatoes for this content. I'm going to build this like a house, so I'm starting at some of the foundational elements. If you go and do a search for my name, Paul Edlund, on the internet, and search for the word cybersecurity, you will find presentations where I've already talked to you about the value of the Digital Crimes Unit. There's a lot of really great presentations out there, but you know, I've done one, so I'm not going to recover all of that stuff. The refresher that I want to put in your mind about the Digital Crimes Unit is that this is really a group of lawyers, predominantly 130, 140 people who work internationally to basically use these novel legal strategies, cutting-edge forensics, and then use a ton of data. So I mentioned that I wasn't going to beat you up with numbers, but here's one of them. We process about 14 billion authentications in the cloud every day. That results in 2.5 terabytes of just log files every single day, right? So lots and lots of data. Lastly, on the realm of this Digital Crimes Unit, you know, they work in conjunction with public agencies and private organizations and many of the people that you would think of that would be our competition in this space. They work with them all because we don't see security as an island. We see it as an ecosystem. And so we need all these piece parts to come together in order to make you guys secure. So we don't think of themselves as islands. As it relates to kind of how the Digital Crimes Unit trickles into the rest of our stuff, we have this group called the Cyber Defense Operations Center. And think of this as like a DevOps kind of a thing. So what does the word DevOps mean? Today, you know, when you walk through a lot of companies, you still see a manager that has all of the storage people reporting to him, or a manager that has the server people reporting to him, or the network folks, or the security folks. And they all look at those as myopic, isolated teams, and they come together to create projects, but they still go back to their cubbyhole of storage, for example. And I'm not picking on storage people, I'm just saying. So DevOps flips that on its ear and it says, you can't do that anymore. You have to think of these groups as interlocked, and a manager needs to report across all of them. So a manager should have the storage, the server, the backup, the security, all those things under their wing. In addition, that same team who creates the solutions is on the hook to fix the problems when they happen. So when that team is on the hook to fix the issues, chances are they're going to be a lot more vested in creating solutions that get up and running more quickly, right? So think of this Cyber Defense Operations Center as DevOps for Microsoft Security. It's a cross-sectional team consisting of the people in this list below, on the slide that kind of give you a sense for how we come together in the event of a security incident, right? So I just want to call that out, that we think of it that way. You probably should too. Next is that, you know, Microsoft truly, truly believes that we are breached right now at this very moment. It's in our soul that we've already been breached. We just make that assumption and we operate as though we are breached 365 days a year. So in order to maintain that constant state of readiness, we employ a full-time team, one for Azure, one for Office 365, called the Blue Team. The Blue Team's full-time job is just to be crazy, crazy paranoid, running around like chickens with their heads cut off saying, where are they? I know that the bad guys must be in here. They've got to be in my servers. No, they've got to be in my storage. They're just constantly looking around trying to figure out where the bad guys went. They know that in part because there's a separate team called the Red Team whose full-time job it is to attack us in production every day of the year. So the interesting thing about these Red Teams and Blue Teams is they don't work together, right? They don't sit in the same areas. They kind of go off and do their own thing. So often the Blue Team will see somebody who's gotten into these one of these different stages, and they won't know if it's another country or one of our actual Red Teamers. The only time that they come together is when the Red Team can't get to the next stage over some arbitrary point of time. They come together, they create notes and recommendation for best practices and other things, and then they break back apart, and the Blue Team goes back to being paranoid again. So, why do I go through this? I put this document up here, or I put this link under here called aka.ms/Red Team Security, which you can see right here. I put that in there so that you guys could download the document and see how we actually do red teaming and blue teaming. We want you to be in the same mindset that we are, not because I have anything to sell you, but because if you put your mindset here, it will change the way you run your business. Next is that we assume that you're really good at running your stuff, right? We make that assumption. We don't assume that we're great and you stink. No, we actually assume that you're really good. And that means that your auditors might need to test us occasionally, right? Or your penetration, your security people might want to test our solutions. As it relates to Office 365, go ahead. You don't need to schedule it. It's software as a service. Go ahead, pen test us. Get in line. We're being pen tested all the time. Azure and Office 365 are purpose-built appliances for security that also happen to do IaaS and PaaS and collaboration and things like that, but they're purpose-built for security. As it relates to Azure, though, we ask that you schedule a penetration test. So in Office 365, because it's software as a service, it's public, right? You can pen test it. But as it relates to Azure, we ask that you schedule it. Well, why? We ask that you schedule it, and here's a link to, I went forward. I meant to zoom in here, see if I can do that again. I created this link called aka.ms/Azure Pen Test. I put that in there because I wanted you to know that if you schedule it, if you don't schedule it, let's just talk about what happens if you don't. If you don't schedule the pen test against Azure, we might, because there's a really tight coupling between our networks, we might see that as a breach and we would disconnect the two tenants from each other. In the hacker realm, this would be referred to as a self-inflicted denial of service attack, right? So don't do one of those, schedule it. Lastly, people often ask how we respond to breaches. And there's some stuff at the bottom of this slide around ISO controls that we actually maintain in order to show you not only how we respond back, but we get audited on it, right? So the thing is that this isn't just something that we do by happenstance. We get audited on how we respond to breaches as well. All right. One of the last things that I want to show you before I start giving you some concrete examples here is that Microsoft is a platform, right? And we think of each of the components as snapping into a larger picture. Full disclosure, I literally have had meetings with our product teams in the course of the last month where I have said, would you please give us slides that show how the broad ecosystem works, and we put those into every single deck. And then when I'm presenting on a subtopic like Windows 10, I show how the security of that component snaps into the larger umbrella, right? Lo and behold, I don't know if I actually was responsible for this slide, but I'd like to think that I had a part in it. It started to show up. So this slide here around the security platform is something that you should see more and more frequently. And as we add more capabilities, you'll see more things come in here, right? I'm going to talk through a few of these today. All right, let's get started with some interesting stuff here. So Kevin is in the room with me here right now, and actually Kevin's holding the handheld cam over there. And I am gonna pick on Kevin for a second because I know for a fact that Kevin is a sucker for videos of cute kittens.
True.
He fessed up right here. I know this for a fact because I've researched Kevin online and I've looked at his Facebook post and his Twitter feed and his LinkedIn profile. And you know, for some reason, Kevin can't stop himself. He's always looking at these two things. He's either talking about his joy for doing these massive productions like we're doing here in the Technology Center, and the other thing that he's talking about is videos of cute kittens. So what do? Is I send Kevin a spear phishing attack, which says, hey Kevin, I know you're gonna love this, buddy. This is a great video of cute kittens. And Kevin's like, I love cute kittens. And he can't stop himself and he clicks on the link. If he had just hovered over that link for just a second, he would have noticed that I changed the O in YouTube to a zero, for example, right? But Kevin doesn't do that. He clicks right on the link and it sends him to a website that looks like YouTube. It feels like YouTube. It smells like YouTube, but it says, hey buddy, before we can show you this video of cute kittens, which we totally want to show you, you need to update your Flash player. And so Kevin's like, oh my gosh, I love cute kittens so much. So he clicks on that thing and it doesn't update Flash. What it really does is it loads something called a listener on his machine. And that listener does nothing initially, but it waits for Kevin to launch another application, maybe like Outlook or Word, for example, or Chrome, it doesn't matter what I pick. And then it waits 5 minutes, and then it kills it. And he launches it, and then it kills it. And he launches it, and then it kills it. Well, Kevin's a techie guy, so what is the first thing that he does is he reboots his computer to see if that'll fix it. But it doesn't fix it. And so the next thing that he says is like, oh my gosh, I need some help. And he calls the help desk. And he says, help desk, my computer's acting like a pig. It keeps shutting, applications keep shutting down. He doesn't tell them about the video of cute kittens, by the way, because that's way too embarrassing. And so what they say is, hang on a second, buddy, we'll log in remotely. And they log into his machine with some elevated credentials, and that listener was waiting. And it takes the user ID of Kevin, along with something called the hash of the password, and it redirects that request to a domain controller, where it uses it to bind to the something called the sys file or the C drive of your domain controller. And then using a tool like Mimikatz or ADSI, it draws down all of the credentials off of that domain controller. And it stores them in a local repository. The next thing that malware does is it uses those credentials, those elevated credentials, to create new accounts or use existing accounts that are not in the domain admins group, but have the same permissions. So it issues the ACLs of being a domain admin without actually putting them in the group. So as an administrator, if you looked in the domain admins group or the enterprise admins group, you wouldn't see Kevin's name listed, but he would have all the same permissions of one of those people now. And then what it would do is create new accounts or use existing accounts, and it would move them around every 5 minutes. So you're playing like whack-a-mole. You kill 5, it creates 10. You kill 20, it creates 30 new ones, right? All of that is creepy, including Kevin's love for cute kittens, but the thing that makes that kind of an anomaly is when it goes sideways, that lateral movement. So there's a great service that Microsoft Consulting Services offers called PopSlam. Now, that is a terrible acronym, by the way, I admit it. To me, it sounds like a British boy band, I don't know why. The thing about this PopSlam stuff is it teaches you how to fish between the legitimate lateral movement, which might be the sharing of files between this machine and another machine, right? Versus the illegitimate lateral movement, which is the me going sideways with that pass the hash attack. By the way, that is a pass the hash attack, not the drug taking exercise, the other one that happens in IT. So what you will notice though, is that PopSlam thing is a service engagement, but I've given you a link down here on the bottom of this slide, very small, aka.ms/PopSlam. Right? I put this into this deck. If you go to that link, you will see an article written by a woman named Jessica Payne. And Jessica actually wrote an article that teaches you guys how to mitigate against the illegitimate lateral movement. Now, the reason why I go through this example is because about, roughly speaking, 2/3 of all malware needs a worming event in order to find a home to live in. In other words, it needs to get from Kevin's computer to a different computer like this one. That warming is something that if you can shut down the warming of an event, that warming event, you in theory have killed off about 60% of all known malware. So I would argue that having this tool in your back pocket around PopSlam is a really good tool to have. Cool? All right. And by the way, I said that I wasn't going to fear you, and then I start fearing you with kittens. You know, the idea here is I'm not trying to scare you. I'm trying to give you the information so that you can use it, okay? So here's the thing. Like, right, we collect all this data. I mentioned that we process these 14 billion authentications in the cloud every day that result in these 2.5 terabytes of log files. There's a few hundred million people touching our cloud services right now at this very minute, right? And so the question that you should be asking yourself, if we've got that much authentication data, and we've got this much port and protocol traffic, and we've got all of this known usage patterns, what do we do with it, right? And so what we do inside of Microsoft land is we said to ourselves, first we need to absorb all this data. So doing that at hyperscale, which, you know, don't get me wrong, Bing and Hotmail and Azure and Office 365, that's hyperscale stuff. Hundreds of thousands of servers working together, right? Millions, of course. The question is, could we put a layer underneath all of that telemetry that helps me find an issue at customer A and maybe have Contoso Insurance benefit as a result of being customer B? And can we do that faster than everybody else on the planet, right? That's the challenge that we set down for ourselves. So I'm going to get up here and walk over to the whiteboard or the Surface Hub that we've got. And I'm going to walk you through a few places that the security graph starts to influence. So I didn't mention the security graph. So let me just show you what happens here inside of our products where we start to expose the way that we're working on this. So if you log in all the time, like here in Irvine, and then 2 seconds later you're in someplace like Rio de Janeiro, we flag that. If you're logging in from a device with no IP address, we correlate those things. That's called a Tor browser, by the way. If you're logging in with a device with a known infection on it, we will correlate that too. And what you're noticing here is in Azure Active Directory, we show that to you front and center, right? You'll be able to see those infection patterns. The other thing is that this digital crimes unit, which I referred to earlier, they play a role on an area of the internet called the dark web. The dark web is where identities and credit cards and social security numbers are bought and sold. If we see one of your credentials being stored on the dark web, we will show them to you here in this area called user, it was an area called users with leaked credentials. And so with a few clicks, you can enable multi-factor authentication on one of those accounts that shows up in this dark web. Now that's the manual way to do it, right? I'm going to walk through how all these pieces come together. The first part is we took all of this telemetry, right? The auth, the protocol usage, the application usage, usage patterns for users, et cetera. And we take all that telemetry in. The layer underneath it is called the security graph. Think of the security graph as like this machine learning, it's like Azure machine learning stuff, like brain in the cloud, where we're looking for usage patterns, right? And when we see that those usage patterns are broken, we flag them. The first place that you see this physically in our stack is in this place called the Security Center. So I'm going to zoom in here, and what you'll notice is, think of this as like a SIEM tool in the cloud. So SIEM is a Security Event Information Management tool like Splunk or QRadar or LogRhythm. So what you're seeing here is like a SIEM tool in the cloud. We would feed this down to your on-premise SIEM solutions, by the way. So what you're seeing here is, for example, traffic from a malicious or to a malicious IP address, a brute force attempt, a distributed denial of service, a critical malware action failing, a SQL injection, for example, right? We correlate all those things. And what you'll notice is this middle column isn't just Microsoft stuff. It's our partners too. It's the people who are also in this space that where your investments rely today. So we're correlating their information and our information ultimately to help you take an action. So we can take that action manually, but what you're seeing here is this last component on the slide is something called the security, so identity protection up above. And what identity protection is think of it as a bunch of rules that represent your business. Right? They're not our rules, they're your rules. And so let's just think of them as like low, medium, high. So low would be like, okay, well, you log in all the time here in Irvine, where I'm at right now, but 2 minutes later, I'm in San Francisco. And that's really not possible to travel there, but it's not without outside of the realm of possibility. Maybe you have a remote desktop session or something. Maybe we just need to audit it. That's low. versus medium, which might be like, you never come in from a device with no IP address, and that's kind of weird. And so maybe what we need to do is have your phone ring to validate who you are. Just make sure. Versus high, which might be in this example, like you showed up on the dark web, you showed up in those users with leaked credentials. We don't trust that you're really healthy anymore. We lock you out until we figure out what's been done, right? Low, medium, high. That's what this thing called identity protection does. It takes those rules and we abide by them. And then now if you're logging into something like Azure or Office 365 or anything that we're federated to, and we federate to 2,700 different services today, all the ones that you would expect, like Amazon and Google and Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and SAP and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, 2,700 of those. If you're federated through us, these rules will also kick in. Cool? All right. Next, I want to show you a few other places that the security graph influences. The first one is this thing called advanced threat analytics. So this is an on-premise solution. And what it is it's a data forensics tool. So what we do is you plug it in, and the easiest way to deploy it is we port mirror your domain controller. So any traffic that goes to a domain controller gets sent to this advanced threat analytics thing. And now what happens is it takes about 3 weeks to understand what normal looks like in your environment. And then what we'll start to do is show you abnormalities. So we know that Kevin, I keep picking on him, he comes in the morning at 7 a.m. He's a call center person. He opens up these five applications. He does this job, and then he leaves at 3 o'clock every day. Now Kevin's coming in at 9 p.m., and he's not opening up any of those applications. He's actually trying to port scan a domain controller or some SQL box. That's totally weird. This will show you that. For an administrator, by the way, that might be a totally normal activity. But for somebody like Kevin in his call center role, not so much, right? So what this advanced threat analytics thing does is it correlates those events on premise. This is not a cloud thing. We get some of the knowledge from the cloud, but we lay down that security graph data from the cloud, but it's an on-premise solution, right? And so the other thing here is you'll notice, like in terms of security issues, if it's something like a broken trust or a weak password or a known protocol vulnerability, we'll show you that in advanced threat analytics. For example, if there's like a SharePoint vulnerability in a down-level version of TLS, which is this encryption thing, right? Maybe we know that. We can show you that, right? And then we see somebody trying to take advantage of that known vulnerability, we'll flag those things. So it knows about known port and protocol vulnerabilities. The second thing is that it understands attacks in real time. So we don't have to train it to understand what a pass the ticket, pass the hash, forge, pack, reconnaissance, brute force thingy looks like. It knows what those are, right? But as it relates to these abnormalities on the bottom, right? It takes us a little bit of time to figure out what Kevin looks like before I can start to understand when Kevin is deviating from his normal day. Cool? All right. So next place that the security graph is starting to influence is this thing called Operations Management Suite. So today, and for a long time, I was a consultant before I came to Microsoft for eons. I mean, and I was doing these things called System Center deployments everywhere. And System Center is a very mature technology, right? It's the thing that you use to manage your stuff. Today's world is a little bit different, though. You might have some investments in things like Amazon, or VMware, or OpenStack, right? Or you might have an investment in Hyper-V and Azure. And so what Operations Management Suite is we move System Center into the cloud, and we manage across all those things. So think of it as a single pane of glass in the cloud where we can see across all of your IaaS and PaaS investments everywhere, our data center, partners' data centers, even what you might think of as a competitor's data center. And now what we're starting to do is correlate some of that information with the security graph. So when somebody logs into a VMware environment, for example, and they're coming from a dark net, we'll show you that kind of stuff. So once again, being influenced by the security graph. Next, we have this thing called cloud app security. In the security realm, this is referred to as a CASB, a cloud access security broker. And this is a company that we bought about a year ago now called Adalom. And Adalom's claim to fame was that they could stand this up in about 8 minutes. So I'm going to triple it. We'll make it 24 just for interesting sake. But the way that this CASB or cloud app security works is that it hooks into your proxies and firewall servers, right? Think of them as plugging right into the side of them. And then we ingest the log files coming off of those services, and we pump rules back into them, right? So before we purchased Adalom, they had partnerships with pretty much all of these all of the proxy and firewall solutions on the planet. We just kind of inherited that. But now what it allows you to do is when somebody's coming through your proxy or firewall with an unmanaged iPad, right? We can see where the files are going. We can understand what users are doing. We can monitor activities. We can block activities. And you're seeing some of these things that we can do here. We can take governance actions, right? We can say, well, if they're going between this service, this SaaS provider like Google and Dropbox, they can do this. But if they're doing it between these two different services, they can do something else, right? That CASB has governance action rules that can kick in. Once again, this assumes that they're behind your firewall, but we can also pump rules into certain numbers of these solution providers as well. And what you're seeing here in the middle part of this, in the middle part right here, is more of that security graph data. What we're seeing now is that person might be communicating with a malicious IP address, or maybe they're communicating with a darknet, or maybe, you know, they're doing something strange, like they're logging into SharePoint on-premise and they're shoving massive amounts of files out to Dropbox. And it will detect those types of anomalistic data or anomalistic types of traffic as well. The next one is this thing called advanced threat protection inside of Office 365. So today, the way that email works, if this is both a product and a licensing thing, so this is a part of a SKU. I'm not a licensing person, but this is a part of a SKU called E5. If you don't own E5, you could buy this a la carte, but if you don't own E5, I just want to explain how it works without E5 or without advanced threat protection. Today, if you send an email into our cloud, it goes like this. So what we'll do is it will come into our service, we'll scan it with one of three antivirus engines, and then what we do is we deliver it to you, right? But here's the issue with that, and it's a wonderful service, and tons of our customers use it, and they're very happy with it. But the thing with that is if when you get that message, it's based on a point in time stamp, right? So let's just say that I sent you a link. I sent Jared over here a link to something, and what happened was when I sent the link to Jared, it was healthy, but suddenly between the time I sent it and the time that he got it, it's become unhealthy, right? So today's service wouldn't pick that up. What happens is that when you have this thing called advanced threat protection, we check that link in real time. And we see, what are other people doing? How many people have gone there? What type of traffic did we expect when they went there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now if it throws it out of whack, we will flag that. And in real time, it will be blocked. Here's the interesting thing about this. If we find out later, like that a link has been, if we find out through the security graph and this machine learning stuff that the link has been infected, we don't leave our other users hanging out to dry. What we do is we pump those rules back into those three antivirus engines so now that they'll pick it up as well. So, but it's just those zero-day exploits. The other half of this advanced threat protection is this thing called a detonation chamber, right? The detonation chamber is a place where if it's an attachment, not a link, but an attachment, we blow it up in the sky before it ever gets to you. And we're checking it for health. And if it makes a registry call or requires some elevation or is doing something like an executable, it won't get to you ever. Right? And so that detonation chamber helps mitigate against some of these new attack vectors that come in through email, as well as the URL rewriting. But it attempts to minimize or help resolve the issues around antivirus engines, which are very much based on signatures and point in time. We have to be more real time, in other words. The next place that you feel the security graph is in this advanced security component of Office 365. So in email now, you're also seeing that data showing up, and I'll zoom it in again here. We're seeing like failed login attempts or people trying to do something or they're coming from a strange location, et cetera, et cetera. Once again, built directly into Office 365, both a licensing thing and a product thing, by the way. I'm not a licensing guy, as I mentioned. But you're starting to see that anomalous stuff inside of Office 365 as well, or the detection of the anomalous stuff, I should say. One of the last ones I want to show you is this thing called Azure App Proxy. And I just want to talk about it in terms of the problem that we're trying to solve. So this is going to seem highly insulting, by the way. I recognize this because I'm going to teach you how networks work. And I know you know how networks work, but follow along with me. So today, you have internet services, right, that you publish through web servers, which talk to application servers, which talk to database servers, for example. And they talk through these layers called DMZs, which are essentially firewall zones, right? And we publish the ports and the protocols between those DMZs so that the web layer can talk to the app layer, can talk to the database layer. But the issue with these is that sometimes, they have zero-day exploits, and it's nobody's fault. I mean, this could be an Apache server, it could be an IIS server, it could be a middleware server running, WebSphere. It doesn't matter. I'm not picking on anybody. It could be all of them. But the point is that sometimes those zero-day exploits pop up in these port and protocols, and it's nobody's fault. And the question that we asked ourselves is there a way that we could minimize that? Maybe not cure it 100%, but really minimize it drastically. The second thing is that people often, or your employees predominantly, but partners too, come in across the internet and they go in through these VPN servers, right? And they use those to connect to the backnet where they access one or more of these things. The problem with VPN is that nobody likes doing it, right? Everybody hates VPN. And if you love VPN, send me a message. I'd love to hear from you. Maybe if you're a VPN manufacturer, you might be sending me messages now. But nobody likes using VPN. It's obtrusive. It's in your way. It just, you don't want to have to think about it, right? So the second question we asked is, could we get people to stop using VPN? Lastly, this Azure App Proxy attempts to solve this last problem, which is roughly, 20 to 30% of this stuff at the edge of your network is just garbage. It's crap. It's people like Microsoft indexing you or Google indexing you. It's people port scanning you, probing your edge, penetration testing you, et cetera, et cetera. And so the last question that we asked ourselves is, could we minimize that or eliminate it altogether, which is that 20% of garbage? So this thing called Azure App Proxy attempts to do that, right? So what happens when you deploy it is you used to have all these DMZs. What we do is we replace them with a single rule and a single firewall that says these two connectors down here can only talk out. So these two connectors can only talk out to the cloud. If you scan from the outside in, you would see exactly nothing. Nothing, right? Because there's only one rule, and it's an outbound rule. And now what we do is we take those URLs and we redirect them to the edge of our cloud. And now what you start doing is, over here, we do a combination of authorization and authentication, meaning who are you, what are you, where are you, and how are you. So I'm Brian. I'm on an iPad. That device is enrolled with MDM, and I'm at McDonald's. Now I'm Brian. I take that same iPad. I move it off to my home or into work, and it's still enrolled with MDM. Or I take MDM off of it. Or I go from an iPad to a PC, right? The combination of who are you, what are you, where are you, and how are you. And what we do is we merge that with these things called conditional access policies, which then kick in and say, okay, well, if you meet these criteria based on the who, what, where, how, I'm only gonna give you read access. Or no, I need your phone to ring. Or no, you get no service. Or maybe you get read only, but for 5 minutes. Or maybe a combination of them, right? Those conditional access policies kick in. Now, we've had conditional access policies for a long time. They were actually built into Server 2012, right? But we keep expanding upon this, and now we're pushing them out to the edge of the edge of the internet, right? So we have the authorization and authentication. Notice that this could be an Android device down here, right? It could just be an Android device talking in across the internet. And this thing has no clue for multi-factor authentication. But because it's terminating in our cloud, now MFA or multi-factor authentication kicks in. Even if you don't have to write the app or rewrite the app in order for it to enable for it. It just happens because we're terminating the communication at the edge of our network. We'll do all the auditing and reporting up in the sky, right? So we'll take all those log files down so that you can bring them on-premise back into your SIEM tools. And we'll proxy, obviously. We'll do security monitoring. We'll take that security graph data in, right? Are you talking from a device with no IP address? Is the device healthy? Are you communicating with a dark net, et cetera, et cetera? And then lastly, we have an access panel. If you guys are evaluating solutions like Okta, this is the same functionality inside of our cloud. So a launching pad with a bunch of icons to all of your service provider applications. And when you click on the link, maybe to Twitter, you never know your user ID and password to Twitter. You just go there. By the way, if the DoD had employed something like this, they would not have had their Twitter account hacked. because we would have been using their actual on-premise credentials to authenticate those users, and they would never know their Twitter ID, and if we had terminated the employee, they would lose access to everything. Lastly, there's two things that are kind of really cool that are great scenarios for our customers now. One is this a concept of extending this solution out to consumers. So Azure B2C just shipped, actually just yesterday, just came out of preview. And so what Azure B2C does is it allows you to keep your Gmail account, your Hotmail account, your Comcast ID, and use that as the authoritative source for your login. But now what we do is we put the metadata in our cloud, and you can put hundreds of millions or billions of users into Azure, and we'll authenticate them with their own credentials. And we can extend those credentials with more metadata, right? Really cool stuff. You used to have to pay, if you think about this in the old world, we would charge you for these user accounts if you put them in something like Active Directory because they were authenticated users. In Azure B2C, we don't charge you. We don't charge you that way. What we do is we pay per the authentication. And this is the worst case scenario licensing. I believe that this is still true. Once again, I'm not a licensing person. Don't hold me to this. But it's about 11/1000th of a penny per authentication. 11/1000th of a penny. So, and as you add more authentications, it goes up and goes down. The price goes down. So Azure B2C is one really great thing. Azure B2B is the second one. In this case, let's just say that Microsoft and United Airlines are partners in something. What we would do is we could say, okay, I will allow United Airlines people to log in with their United Airlines credentials, and they will authenticate against me, and they can keep their credentials. When United terminates them, they lose access to my service. We enable this same type of functionality in the cloud as well. If we're both on Office 365 or Azure, nothing else to do. If we're not, there's a process where we can enable them to do that. It's just a little more complicated, but the idea is that you can either, if you're in our cloud, it just kind of happens. If you're not, it's not terribly complicated, but we stand up a process that allows them to register their domain and start to authenticate against that cloud as a partner as well. Awesome things. So back to my desk over here. I'm going to put my pen back. And what I want to talk to you now about briefly is a little bit about the zombie fortress. I've kind of moved away from the zombies for a while. I'd like to come back because it's my comfort zone. And actually, the zombie fortress is an interesting idea because what we really want to do is we want to keep the zombies out and we want to keep the stuff that we love in. Right? Your food, your ammo, all of your toys, your kids, whatever it is you want to keep, you want to put it inside the fortress, right? So what I'm going to do is just kind of give you a sense for, I've talked to you about how we kind of keep some of the bad guys out. Now I'm going to kind of flip that around how you keep some of the good stuff in. So this is another example that I'm going to use with you guys briefly about how we actually operate our platform. And it's this concept of humans govern and code operates. I did not coin this. A very great person on our Azure team, a woman on our Azure team, was the first place I ever heard it. But I'm going to explain how we open up trouble tickets in our cloud. So today, if you have an Azure virtual machine, right, and it's running, and let's just say that it's flaking out for whatever reason, you would open up a support ticket, either by calling us or by calling your technical account manager and opening up a Premier support ticket. That ticket would get dropped into a queue. That queue would be assigned to a manager, right? That manager is presented with a list of all of their tickets, as well as the resources that are allowed to close those tickets. What happens next is that a manager, by the way, that list, I should say, those list of engineers is pre-screened. So in the US, we rescreen our cloud employees every 2 years. We make sure that they're not on any government no-fly list, any watch list. They haven't been trade debarred, et cetera, et cetera. And we recheck that every 2 years. We also make sure that they've completed all their training and all of their certification exams, et cetera. If they've met all those criteria, though, what happens is a manager can click on one or more of their names. What happens next is those administrators, those engineers, are issued one-time user IDs and passwords to run a script for a period of minutes. We don't leave administrators, domain admins, or enterprise admins laying around just to kind of do whatever they want. We have a handful of service accounts that are like the magical keys, and those are locked down with a bunch of policies and procedures, but there's nobody that you can point to inside of Microsoft land that has a standing elevated permission. It doesn't exist, right? So what happens is an engineer is issued a one-time user ID and a password to run a script for a period of minutes. What happens next is they log into this thing called a jump server. They type in their regular user ID and password. Their phone rings. Right? They have to type in a PIN code on their phone. And then what happens is they're now presented with a screen where they log in the temporary one-time user ID and password, and they run their script. What you would get back is the success or the failure of the script, the time that it started, the time that it stopped, what engineer kicked it off, et cetera, all the way back through the chain. Now, the thing about this is that this is called just-in-time provisioning and just-enough administration. And you guys should be doing this on-prem as well, and there's a few ways that you can actually do it. One is that you could design something called a red forest. Take my word for it, you do not want to go down this route unless you absolutely have to. It's a huge pain in the butt, costs a lot of money because partners get paid a ton, and I love partners, I'm just saying, they get paid a lot when you do a red forest design. A red forest design often stems up as a last resort ditch effort, a last ditch effort when you get breached. Because it's a way for you, remember when I sent Kevin the links of videos of cute kittens, what happened was is we built all these service accounts out of non-administrators and local service accounts, right? And now they're moving around. They're moving so fast in some cases that you're not quite sure if you've gotten them all. And if there's just one laying around and he springs up later, you know, you have to be able to mitigate against it. And so this red forest design is kind of a last ditch effort. Having said that, there are two other ways that you can get JIT and JEA. One is you could go out and buy a tool. Microsoft makes one of those tools called Microsoft Identity Manager. There's third parties that do it as well. And then the last thing that you could do is you could wait for Server 2016 to ship later on this year. It's going to have JIT and JEA built in. So what I've done is here in the deck, I've actually put a link to the JIT and JEA demo that I've got right here. It's aka.ms/JIT demo. And this shows you how that will work in Server 2016. So I mentioned to you about 2/3 of all breaches initially come through this idea of worming, right? The other roughly 1/3 of the breaches require elevated credentials. So if you employ these two things, securing against lateral account movement, and if you've removed the ability or reduced the ability for people to create elevated credentials, in theory, you have taken a large surface area of attack vectors off of the playing table for you or your customers. So those two things are things that I would have you really double down your efforts on. One is securing lateral account movement. The other one is reducing or eliminating your standing administrators or enterprise admins or domain admins. Awesome stuff. Really quickly, protecting the content from the inside out is more than just an administrative action. We have this thing inside of Office 365 called data loss prevention. Now, data loss prevention is triggered based on your rules, and this is like a WYSIWYG tool where you actually click on this plus sign and it creates a wizard and it walks you through the process, right? And you could say, okay, well, we're merging with somebody and I want to make sure that nobody talks about the merger, so we'll look for the keywords of that merger. Or maybe we've got this type of a document, which is a contract, or it's an agreement between a customer and the company, your company, for example, and we want to make sure that those don't leave the company for whatever reason. You could build these DLP rules and then use DLP document fingerprinting within SharePoint and Exchange inside of Office 365 to hunt those things down. And when the rules are met, we apply a bunch of stuff based on whatever that stuff is that you want. The issue that I've got, or it's not just me, but the issue that we have with this is that it only gets triggered if you employ Office 365 or Exchange online, soon to be on-prem, but today it's online. So I've got something that'll show you how we mitigate that. What would happen if it started on a PC and it went to a thumb drive? How would we mitigate against that, right? So how do we do this comprehensive information protection? The first thing is that we've got to protect the device, right? So we have device protection, and the second thing we have to do is we have to separate the corporate data from the personal data. Because if we wipe out your device, we don't want to wipe out your kid's picture, and you know, for me, I'm a DJ, I would hate it if somebody wiped out my music collection, it would drive me nuts. The next stage is we want to make sure that it doesn't leak. So things that need to stay behind your firewall should always stay behind your firewall, or they need to stay in your company's control. And then lastly, sometimes you need to share this stuff, right? So how do we put a process in place where we can actually share things between me and my mom, maybe for a totally legitimate reason, right? So there are four pieces that come together to help us fill these voids. On the protecting the device side, we employ BitLocker, right? It's the disk encryption component of it. So if somebody leaves a PC in a cab, we're still relatively safe from a perspective of the disk being encrypted. The next stage is protecting the data. We need to understand if it's your data or our data. And we have this new capability called Windows Information Protection. It used to be called Enterprise Data Protection, EDP, before we actually released it. Now it's called Windows Information Protection. What that does is we know all of the enterprise applications, and when content is being created, we understand what corporate content is, and we understand what personal content is. And if we have time, maybe if somebody has a question about it, I can show you my File Explorer. I've been updated to the anniversary update, and now inside of my PC, I see a column that says, this is Microsoft corporate stuff, this is my personal stuff, and I can still move it off from corporate to personal, but then it makes me audit, or creates an audit trail of why I did that, for example. And then lastly, we want to be able to share content. Now you'll notice that there's an overlap here between what WIP, the Windows Information Protection, does and this thing called Azure Information Protection, as well as Office 365 do. They all work together. So one is about protecting and keeping your content or keeping your corporate data corporate and your personal data personal. But then when it needs to be shared, we start to blur the lines or blend the lines between what Windows Information Protection provides and Azure Information Protection, or what Office 365 does with DLP policies. It's all the same rules, but they just kick in different ways based on your rules, right? So one of the last things I want to tell you about is, this is a literal email to my mom. And my mom does this to me all the time. She'll call me and she'll be like, honey, I keep forgetting how to post pictures to Facebook. And could you please upload the pictures for me? I've sent you an email with my user ID and password. And I'm like, Mom, would you please stop sending me your password and email? I've told my mom, like, I shame you in my presentations. Now I'm doing this nationally or internationally, depending on where you're viewing from. She'll love this. So if Mom, if you're watching, sorry, I'm shaming you publicly here too. And my mom, I told my mom, like, stop sending me your password. And she's like, okay, honey, I won't send you my password, but is it still okay if I help you do it? If you help me do it? I'm like, sure, just don't send me your password. And she said, cool. So many times people will talk to you about this thing called Windows Hello, but they won't tell you why we did it. So a few things come together really quickly. One is that we have these new sensors inside of these devices called Windows Hello capable sensors. And they're infrared and depth sensors and web cameras that they come together to measure your face or your iris or your thumbprint, for example. The other part of this is this thing called Passport, where we store the math of my face digitally on a TPM. So it's not stored as my face. It's actually stored as a cryptographic version of my face. It's not like you could take the cryptographic version and put it on another machine and use it. It doesn't work that way. It's registered with the device. Now, I'm going to actually, on my phone, I've got this same capability. But what I'm going to do is lock my workstation. And what you're going to see kick in here is it's going to say, getting ready. And it says, looking for you. Now, I've got stage lights on me. Hopefully, this will still work. It says, making sure it's you. And it eventually, stage lights, I should cover over the stage lights here. Hot stage lights don't help. Let's try it one more time. I'll put my glasses on just for giggles. Looking for you, making sure it's you. Ha! Oh, there it is. Hello, Paul. Swipe to dismiss. And what it does, I have to swipe because if I lock my workstation, right, and I step away, and I haven't quite stepped away, or I start talking with Kevin, for example, it would log me back in. That would defeat the purpose. That's why it makes me swipe. But here's the thing, is today's passwords, today, like I mentioned, if when you log in, we send the public key across the wireless, which is my user ID, P. Edlund, or Paul EDL, right? The next thing that goes across the wire is the hash of my password. On Windows 7, Windows 8, and older versions, and even other operating systems, something goes across the wire called the hash of your password. That hash is the cryptographic version of my password, right? Now, there's something coming in about 7 to 10 years called a quantum computer, which I'm not going to go into too much detail on, and I'm not making this up. Quantum computers will be able to decrypt some of the largest keys that we have in a little under 10 hours. And when they get to about 9 quantum bits, by the way, which is I've talked about this publicly too. Do a search for Paul Edlund cybersecurity. You'll see other presentations where I've talked about quantum computers. What happens with Windows 10 and Windows Hello is that instead of the hash of my password going across the wire, what happens instead is something called a nonce goes across, an N-O-N-C-E, which is a one-time negotiation between this and whatever I'm talking to. The next time I log in, it's a different nonce. So in theory, I've taken the cryptographic version of the password off of the wire. If something's sitting in the middle, there's nothing to sniff off because it's a one-time negotiation. The next time I log in, it's a different, totally different thing. So Windows Hello is important because we're starting to get passwords off of the wire. No more passwords. And what you'll notice with this in Windows 10 Anniversary Update is we've extended this to the browser and to line of business applications. So pretty soon, I'll be logging into Facebook. I'll never know my user ID and password. It'll use my face or my thumbprint or my iris, and I'll never know my password, which would be awesome. I don't want to know it. Lastly, I want to tell you just really quickly about this thing that's coming called Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection. And today's solutions like antivirus, they only really care about your device. They don't care about your device in conjunction with somebody else's device. I talked to you about a breach around death by kittens. Now I'm going to tell you one that the Secret Service told me when I was presenting on a panel with them one time. There are people out there who legitimately only want your financial statements 3 days before they hit the street. They want to do this because they want to play the stock market ahead of your earnings announcement so they can make millions of dollars. The way that that works, and I'm oversimplifying it because his detail was a lot more than this, but basically they call your executive admin and they say, hey, you know, it's Joe from the help desk. I need you to make a physical change to your printer. Could you do that for me? And they're like, oh, I don't trust you. Who are you, Joe? I don't know Joe at the help desk. He's like, well, call me back at the help desk. I'm a new employee. Just call me back. Okay, they call him back and they found a way to spoof the phone number. And after they confirm that, the person makes that physical change to the printer. Now, it's a physical change. It may be going to properties of the printer and change something. Next, what they'll do is they will call the executive, the person who the executive admin works for, and they'll say, hey, it's, you know, Joe from the help desk, and we created a new policy document that I need you to look at. It's around our BYOD strategy, and could you just open the document? I just sent it to you. Oh, you don't know who I am? Call me back, blah, blah, blah. So he opens up that document, and it does a drive-by attack. Right? And that's not a virus because nobody else has ever seen it. There's no signature. He's exploiting something 0 day that maybe that is an early research project that nobody else has ever seen. And those two attack vectors are used in conjunction with each other. Now when the executive sends the earnings statement to the secretary before that person prints it off, it sends a copy to him. And now he plays the stock market 5 days or 3 days ahead of your earnings statements. And he does that 5 times. He calls in rich. He's done. He only needs to do it 5 times. Today, you would think that a hacker event is something where they try and brute force attempt a ton of people. No, these guys only care about getting into you. And they'll use combinations of long trails and many computers working in conjunction with each other. This is what advanced threat protection attempts to do. It will combine multi-phase attacks using machine learning, the same security graph type of data. We're going to do event correlation and orchestration across users and devices, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to be a part of Windows 10 Anniversary Update. It just got enabled on my box as well. I see a new service called the Windows Defender ATP service on my box. We're going to integrate it with third-party tools at some point. And we have this cloud reporting dashboard. So what does that look like? So in the Security Center, which is something I showed you a long time ago, you would notice that there's this thing where it says the NeroBlaze is attacking you right here. It says NeroBlaze attack detected. Well, who the heck is NeroBlaze, right? So if you drill down, it would say, here's a description of what NeroBlaze does. He wants your financial statements 3 days before they hit the street, blah, blah, blah. And we're seeing that telemetry and traffic inside of your environment. Here's what it looks like, right? So notice that some of these might be port and publishing, registry changes. Some of them might be, which are physically done. Some of them might be scripted processes, et cetera, et cetera. All these things coming together. So, you survived the zombie apocalypse, and look at that, I almost got it right in under the hour. So the last thing that we wanted to do, before I get to some questions, some Q&A, Kevin's going to cue me up here, we created a cool new document that was just released this week that bridges all these things together around cybersecurity, and so I rebranded it to Zombie Security. So if you go to aka.ms/zombie security, you'll see it. But thank you guys so much, and with that, I think we want to open it up in case there are any questions. Kevin, did we have anybody who... had any piercing questions that they wanted answered today? We're going to wrap up, but once again, if you ever want to reach out, we'd love to hear from you as well, so please keep questions coming. My alias is pauledl@microsoft.com, and with that, thank you so much for your time. I'm glad you guys were able to watch this show, and good luck. Thanks.